Hello and welcome to the IEA's podcast. I'm Annabel Denham, Director of Communications at the Institute of Economic Affairs, and I'm joined today by Professor Len Shackleton, the IEA's Editorial and Research Fellow. We're here today to discuss Oxfam's 2021 poverty report titled The Inequality Virus.
It says that the increase in wealth of the world's top 10 billionaires during the pandemic is more than enough to both pay for a COVID-19 vaccine for everyone on the planet and to reverse the rise in poverty caused by the coronavirus. The charity is calling for higher taxes on the very richest, as well as a temporary tax on excess profits made by the 32 global corporations that have gained the most in the past year. It is calculated that the combined wealth of those 10 wealthy billionaires rose by $540 billion from mid-March to the end of last year. In short, hundreds of millions of people are being forced into poverty, while many of the richest individuals and corporations are thriving.
Now, this is compelling stuff. Anyone reading it would assume that there's something fundamentally wrong with our current economic system and that something needs to be done to urgently address wealth inequality. What would you say to that, Len?
I think there are problems in the world economy. There have always been problems in the world economy. But we need to be sure that the analysis we have of these problems makes sense. And the policy proposals which come out of it are things which are doable and will not have the sort of unpredicted effects which actually often accompany a lot of headline-making government policy.
So when it comes to looking at the unintended consequences of some of these proposals, you know, let's take one example. Let's start with perhaps the most eye-catching proposal, and this is the demand for a temporary increased profit tax on 32 global corporations that have gained most in the pandemic. How would you unpick this suggestion?
It's a very attractive suggestion in a way. You've got these global corporations making lots of money during the pandemic and indeed most of the time. But how do you actually tax them? They're global corporations. They're located in very different parts of the world. So no government by itself can impose taxes like this and expect to get very much from them. So it's got to be some international cooperation on this. And of course, this is extremely unlikely. But even if you did manage to do this, profits taxes are a classic thing where economists' understanding of the effects of profit taxes are very different from that of the ordinary, untrained economist. The evidence is that the costs of them don't fall particularly on the super rich. They certainly fall on people who get dividends, but that includes many pension funds and so forth. But more importantly, firms react to profits tax by trying to reduce their costs elsewhere. So they can, if they're in a market where they can get away with it, they shove up prices so the consumer loses out. But more likely, they cut back on what they're prepared to pay workers. And there is some evidence that about 65% of the cost of profits taxes ultimately falls on workers and not on the super rich, which these are aimed at.
Now, let's really quickly run through some of the other proposals in the report and just get your thoughts on them. One of the proposals is for a maximum wage. What are your views on that?
The idea of setting maximum or minimum things, for that matter, is a bit of a red rag to a bull to economists, because we see that attempts to rig the market in this way, and Oxfam talk about rigging the market, but this is rigging the market. It's trying to prevent market forces from operating. Maximum wages. Well, we know in the past, I'm old enough to remember incomes policies, which Britain endured for several decades, really, in one form or another. And people get round maximum wages. They get round them by employers offering cheap accommodation, special perks, travel perks, things like this. It's very difficult to control these things. The other thing, of course, about it is that elsewhere in the forest of proposals, Oxfam are saying they want to increase income tax. Well, fair enough, you can increase income tax. But of course, if you're setting a maximum wage, and I think they talk about £100,000 a year, then this is going to substantially reduce your take from high earners. It will not be as easy to tax many of the perks which high earners will get if they're prevented from getting pay in terms of pounds.
Now, in addition to the proposal for a maximum wage, we have the authors calling for a guaranteed income. How do you think that they expect this might work in practice? And what would the unintended consequences of such a proposal be?
Well, if you can make any sense of this, it probably means that we want some kind of universal basic income, which is a proposal which has been talked about for 200, 300 years. It's received a lot of mileage recently by people both on the right and the left, and there are arguments in favour of a universal basic income. But the thing is, it would be extremely costly to do this. It would not, you know, some of the people on the right who support the universal basic income say, oh, well, we can cut back on much of the elaborate and confusing welfare system which we have, and it'd be cheaper to administer and so forth. Yeah, but that will be at the cost of people who at the moment receive very high levels of welfare benefits because of disabilities and all sorts of problems like that. In order to that they will get the same amount of money which they would have had before UBI, then the UBI has got to be at incredibly high levels, 20,000 a year, 25,000 a year, which are probably very close to average earnings. So this is it is not a simple matter. It's not a feasible matter. And of course, this doesn't address in any way the concerns, the global concerns of Oxfam, which are about poverty in less developed countries, where there isn't the infrastructure to enable a guaranteed income. And the general level of output and productivity in those countries isn't enough to support a guaranteed income of any level at all. So this is not it's an attractive sounding idea, but when you actually try to get down to implementing it, I think you'll find that it is not an easy thing to do.
And let's go back to the pandemic around which the authors have framed this report. They've insisted that there must be open access to all relevant patents and technologies so that cheap vaccines can be produced. Again, this is quite compelling rhetoric. It's like when Jeremy Corbyn insisted back in November that a vaccine should not become a privatized commodity used for corporate profiteering. He said it should be a global public good and shared with the world. I mean, what do you make of this insistence that there should be this open access to patents and technology?
Well, our whole, you know, big pharma infrastructure really is based on firms investing money, often in areas which the return is extremely risky type of investment. And the incentive for this is that if they succeed in getting a vaccine or a drug or whatever, then they're able to make some kind of profit on it. And most big innovations of this kind have eventually percolated through in cheaper versions and so on. But you do need a period of time when firms behind a patent barrier are able to recoup some or hopefully more of their investment. So what is being proposed really is you abandon that system completely. And so if the private sector has no incentive to create vaccines or better drugs or whatever it may be, then the government is going to have to step in. Governments are going to have to undertake this kind of investment. Governments aren't particularly well qualified to do this. They're subject to all sorts of lobbying, pressure groups and so forth. Particular scientists tell them one story, other scientists tell them other stories. And of course, it's government money, government makes a commitment, and that's everything is aimed in that direction, at producing that particular type of drug or whatever it may be. Whereas the private sector is capable of going off in different directions, doing different things, serendipity, finding new things, and so on. I think a world where only governments invested in drugs and vaccines and so forth would be one where we had far less innovation, far less discovery than the private sector is capable of.
Now, in response to this report, you've made the point that Oxfam, while it's had its own scandals in recent years, has got a decent record on providing famine aid and using development funds in modest projects to improve living standards. Why do you think that it is that the charity is focusing on issues such as these, and this is how they're choosing to deploy charitable donations, engaging in this anti-capitalist rhetoric rather than focusing on how we improve the living standards of the poorest?
Charities like Oxfam recruit from people who are very committed to change, to social justice as they see it, and so on. It's not a random draw from the population. And, you know, people who work for Oxfam, work for other charities of a similar kind, are committed to change, they want to change things, and they get involved in politics very easily. And one of the things, of course, which is worth drawing attention to is when Oxfam started, I remember it was basically famine relief when it started. This was donation driven by the public who were concerned with issues of famine in poor economies. Nowadays, you know, only a relatively small proportion of the income of Oxfam comes from donations and legacies. A lot more of it comes from government. About 45% last year of its income came from government in one form or another, or from the Oxfam shops, which you see all over the place, which raise quite a lot of money, which essentially selling secondhand goods and so forth, and incidentally driving out many things like secondhand bookshops and so forth. That's a different story. So the point is that Oxfam, like many other charities, now focuses a lot of its work on lobbying and advocacy and trying to persuade the government to cough up money or governments across the world to cough up money rather than donations. I think that's unhealthy because if you are relying on donations, then you have to respond to what the people who are giving you money actually want from this. Oxfam now doesn't have to do this or doesn't do this on anything like the same scale. And it's worth bearing in mind, of course, that in this report, which slags off the white white males, basically, which I'm obviously one, but many of the traditional donors to Oxfam and other similar charities are in fact white males. Moving away from your audience, if you like, towards mm-hmm. lobbying for government is a dangerous area, and I think it's something which we ought to reflect on. Oxfam is now basically a campaigning body as much as it is a body which is trying to raise money to support sensible projects. Now, if I just go back to, I have a lot of respect for the work which Oxfam has done in the past. Famine relief, as I say, was its initial motivation, but it's also obviously developed over the years development projects on relatively small scales, which have usually turned out to be fairly effective, certainly by comparison with the kind of large scale aid programs which governments have intervened in, where they involved themselves in, which have often produced disastrous outcomes or certainly ineffective outcomes.
I mean, it's one thing to unpick Oxfam's inequality report and to lament how it is anathematizing the market economy, I believe you put it. But what proposals would you put forward to try and foster economic growth in developing countries and to address, lifting the poorest out of poverty?
Well, this assumes that governments or clever economists and so on have a key to doing these things, but they don't. What will lift countries out of poverty is the opportunity to engage in trade, to engage in economic activity without corruption, governments which are preventing people from doing things, are taxing them excessively, and so on. By far the greatest, I think, thing which has improved living standards in Africa in recent years, for example, is the invention of the mobile phone, which has enabled many businesses to start up and for people to buy and sell, to start their own activities and so on, in a way which very few government-led projects have ever managed to do.
Right. Thank you, Len. I think that's all we have time for, but it's a really fascinating discussion. And to those of you listening, there is more content on this topic on the IEA's website, which we will also put in the show notes. If you like what you just heard, please do consider subscribing to the IEA's podcast. It's available on Podbean, on Spotify, and on Apple.